Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transverse Myelitis Association's Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Relapsing versus Monophasic Rare Neuroimmune Disorders. My name is Sam Hughes, and I will be moderating this podcast today. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message to the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Cynthia Wang. Dr. Wang received her medical degree from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, and completed a pediatrics and pediatric neurology residency at Mott Children's Hospital at the University of Michigan Health System in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Dr. Wang completed her James T. Lubin Fellowship under the mentorship of Dr. Benjamin Greenberg at UT Southwestern and Children's Health in Dallas. She is currently an assistant professor at UT Southwestern in the departments of pediatrics and neurology and neurotherapeutics. Welcome, Dr. Wang, and thank you for joining us today.
Yes. Hi. Thanks, Sam. Thank you for the TMA for inviting me. It's a pleasure to come on and talk about these really important issues.
Yeah. So we thought this would be an important topic. There are always a lot of questions, and I'm sure you get a lot of these questions as a clinician working with these disorders, really specifically about these relapsing versus monophasic, what that means, what is a relapse, and because there can be a lot of gray area, even though there are, you know, diagnostic criteria. And we wanted to highlight the fact that Dr. Wang has written some really nice, concise documents that are posted on the TMA website, myelitis.org, that addresses this topic directly, that are really good reference sheets, I think not only for people living with these disorders, but also other clinicians who might be ignorant to these disorders or are unaware of some of the ins and outs of how they work. There are two documents there. One is called Facts About Rare Neuroimmune Disorders, the 5 W's, and the other one is more of a general Q&A on relapsing versus monophasic rare neuroimmune disorders. And so the way we wanted to organize this podcast today was to really spend the first half, the first up to 30 minutes or so, having Dr. Wang describe these documents, what you find in them, giving broad strokes from the clinician's perspective about how these different rare neuroimmune disorders fall in these different categories of relapsing versus monophasic. And then spend the second half going through some of the questions that came in from the community to get into a little bit more detail as it pertains to some of the diseases or some examples that one might come across. So first, Dr. Wang, I thought we could go through this 5 W's. So as you were putting this together, what were you thinking when you thought about the 5 W's, or could you describe what that means?
Yeah, no, I think it is a helpful framework for me to think about these conditions because they often affect different demographic groups. Some tend to be younger children, such as acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, or ADEM, and acute flaccid myelitis, which we both typically see in younger children, versus diseases such as neuromyelitis optica, spectrum disorder associated with aquaporin-4 antibodies. That's characteristically described as very typically older women in their 30s and 40s. So I think wanting to give a framework not only for myself to kind of talk about these, but also for patients to see if they fit in one category and if that can at least drive their thinking and their medical decision-making into, you know, one of these sort of, you know, boxes. And with that said, these boxes are changing a lot. And probably by the time this goes out, there may be something that's different from what I've said, but at least a good framework to start off from.
Yeah. And the 5 W's, or for those who are wondering what we mean when we say the 5 W's, yeah, is something that is used in, I think, a lot of different worlds of the who, where, what, which of these conditions tend to be relapsing recurring, and why. The five W's, as we approach rather complicated topics or processes, to help with our thinking. So first, Dr. Wang, would you like to dive in a little bit into who gets these different illnesses, or who would you expect how would you categorize them just broadly?
Yeah, so for many of them, it's variable, and probably there's not any specific group that is unaffected, except for maybe the, you know, infants. They typically don't tend to have these conditions, just because our thought is many of these are immune mediated, and usually the immune system has to mature and be exposed to certain things before you can have immune dysfunction. But yeah, we've seen anywhere from young children, grade school children, adolescents. You know, many of these affect people, you know, prior to the age of 50. So I think if it's somebody who's much older, then it's a little atypical, and then they also have more potential mimics. But I would say, you know, there's really no one answer if you can get these diseases. It really affects the whole spectrum of ages. With that said, I think we can, again, to kind of echo what I previously said, you know, certain diseases tend to happen in children, certain diseases tend to happen in older adults, but I've seen exceptions to that rule, several times. So I don't think age should be an absolute indicator, but sometimes that helps interpret, you know, symptoms and test findings in a light that makes more sense. So I think I would say, and this may get to the next question, like where the inflammation is. I think a lot of times people get confused, like if I have optic neuritis, does that make it mutually exclusive for me to have something else like NMO or MS? And I think, you know, when you talk about where the inflammation is, that can sort of help guide that question. Optic neuritis very plainly just means inflammation in the optic nerves. So it's really a symptom, and we don't actually, there's no built-in like definition of what causes that unless we do other testing. The same thing with transverse myelitis, very much it just means inflammation in the spinal cord. And as many of the listeners may know, that can be a part of any of these conditions, or at least many of them. And then ADEM or encephalitis means inflammation of the brain, sometimes spinal cord, sometimes optic nerve. So I just want to kind of clarify that point, because I definitely hear a lot of questions. You know, once I've been given this diagnosis, then, you know, can that still change over time? Does it make it, you know, does it rule out other things? And I think we'll get to more questions about that.
Yeah. And kind of to, you know, you were getting to the second W, the where. And in this document, it's where in the nervous system do these disorders affect. And you were getting to that in your last answer, but I would wonder as well, you know, if there's a patient presenting with inflammation in one location versus two locations, if you're looking at it, does that also drive your decision making as it pertains to one or another of these diagnoses?
Definitely. So I think that the classic example would be if there's inflammation in both optic nerves and the spinal cord, so optic neuritis and transverse myelitis, and that is often seen with what we call neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. Historically, that's mostly been defined as the illness associated with these antibodies to a water channel in the central nervous system called aquaporin 4. But I think in the past few years in particular, we've seen, you know, typically younger people who test negative for these aquaporin 4 antibodies and actually have an antibody towards something called MOG, myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein. So, but I would say if there were simultaneous or sequential involvement of the optic nerves and the spinal cord, NMOSD would certainly be part of my differential, and that would lead me to test for those antibodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can see also just from my experience observing the clinicians, you know, a big confounder, or not confounder necessarily, but a differential is, you know, multiple sclerosis. You know, when you have somebody presents with a spinal cord lesion or an optic neuritis, the most common thing you most people would think about is multiple sclerosis, maybe. But we all know, everybody who's listening to this knows that these are not one and the same. And you know, there are different clues that I believe you as clinicians kind of look for when you're looking at MRIs or clinical history, to kind of parse out what is potentially a multiple sclerosis disease process versus the NMOs or the TMs of the world. So I don't know if you want to speak a little bit to how that gets parsed out.
Sure. Yeah. There's, you know, there's been a very large body of literature on multiple sclerosis. It's not felt to be a direct antibody-related disease. That's never been found. So, in some ways, we're a little bit smarter when it comes to MOG and aquaporin form, because we sort of have a better understanding of what the direct target is. But multiple sclerosis is often a diagnosis that is based on changes of new lesions in different parts of the central nervous system over time. So sometimes with the first presentation of optic neuritis or transverse myelitis, you can't necessarily, and often you can't make that diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, which is important that these people, individuals who have these initial demyelinating syndrome, establish care with a neurologist and be followed clinically and radiologically over time. There are some things that we can use to substantiate a potential case or make a case for multiple sclerosis, such as looking at different aspects of the spinal fluid. In particular, there's something called oligoclonal bands, which are very characteristic of multiple sclerosis. And if someone were to have actually more than one lesion in the central nervous system and the presence of oligoclonal bands, that's one of the few cases you can make that diagnosis on the spot. So I think part of looking for these non-MS mimics is to do that workup, getting the neuroimaging. MS tends to like to have lesions in specific spots near the ventricles, where the brain surrounds the cerebral spinal fluid, in other specific parts of the brain. And in the spinal cord, it tends to have smaller, shorter lesions, sometimes called skip lesions, but not the longitudinally extensive, more than three vertebral segments that we see with NMO. So those are some clues. And then I think because we have these tools to test for these antibodies, the existence of one of these antibodies actually makes a pretty good case against multiple sclerosis. So that's another reason we test. If you have one of these other antibodies, we have a pretty good clue that this is not going to look like MS, and you know, and that's could be a very different trajectory and change management quite a lot.
There's a lot of detail associated with it. Experience that a clinician has to have in order to see the differences, but it's good to know that we're learning more just every day. Moving on to the third W, really, I think the question that's on everybody's mind as it really pertains to this podcast is the what does monophasic or relapsing mean? Some of these disorders are by diagnostic definition monophasic, meaning that it only happens once, and some are by definition relapsing or could happen multiple times. But some of it is a little blurry, and it's scary for a patient to have a first attack and not be able to be told whether they should expect it again or this is a one-time thing. So Dr. Wang, could you speak a little bit more to how you think about monophasic versus relapsing and how these neuroimmune disorders fall into those categories?
Sure. So, you know, I think we can try to simplify these. Monophasic just means a one-time event, and that sort of requires us to kind of be, you know, look into the future. And sometimes we don't have the information at the first acute demyelinating episode. Presumably, everybody could be diagnosed as monophasic, but it really takes the unfolding of time and new symptoms, if they were to come up, that can really definitively answer that question. So, you know, if you had one clear inflammatory episode with objective evidence of inflammation in the MRI or the spinal fluid, and then had another attack many months later, then you would meet criteria for relapsing. there are certain conditions that we have a pretty good idea just from natural history studies are monophasic. That includes things, probably the one most that I would say on this list would be acute flaccid myelitis. And that one is slightly different. The other ones we think maybe the immune system becoming dysfunctional leads to the bulk of the injury of the condition. In acute flaccid myelitis, it's a little different. We're mostly thinking now that this is a virus-driven process, similar to the polio virus, in which the polio can kill off different parts of the spinal cord. We think in AFM, it may be a slightly different virus called enterovirus. So we have not yet seen any of these children or young adults typically who get this disease ever have another episode again. So I think it gets to the fact that this is a different mechanism. It's a virus coming in contact with a susceptible individual, not that the individual is mounting a perturbed or dysfunctional immune response. And then kind of on the very other end of the spectrum, and then we'll go to the ones that have more gray, neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder associated with aquaporin 4 antibodies. Many natural history studies suggest that those people, their immune system never really corrects itself. It never learns that it's being maladapted, and those antibodies persist over time. And generally, if we do not treat those people, they will have relapses, and they can be quite devastating relapses. So really a one-time syndrome with a positive aquaporin 4 antibody is what, you know, I think many of us will use to recommend sort of indefinite immunotherapy. And then, you know, I'll pause there because I think that was already a lot, but we can now talk about some of the other things. And again, an optic neuritis, a transverse myelitis, if it's the first event, it's hard to know for sure unless you have some of these other features that tell us that you look like one of these other syndromes.
Mm. So it's really, it really sounds like, well, it underscores the importance of ongoing follow-up care after the initial, coming to the physician, because you don't really know. You can't necessarily say, especially for an optic neuritis or transverse myelitis, if it's going to be a one-time event or ongoing. There might be maybe clues in terms of their history or what the lesion looks like that might make you guess in one direction or the other. But at the end of the day, you can't definitively say without following over time. So it really is important to be continue following with your neurologist and have ongoing work to make sure that you know, if maybe this is a relapsing disorder that you have, it's caught as quickly as possible and can be managed accordingly. Moving on, so we even just kind of talked about which is the fourth W, which tends to be relapsing or recurring, as you described, Dr. Wang, NMO being a major one, but also kind of the gray area.
Yeah, I'll touch upon, I didn't really talk about because I guess multiple sclerosis is definitely a big one, but most people find their way to the Transverse Myelitis Association because, you know, their provider's thought is they likely don't have multiple sclerosis, but that is definitely one that tends to be relapsing over time, which is why that field has definitely moved toward earlier detection, earlier treatment. That's why somebody who has acute demyelinating event, it's very important for them to undergo the multiple sclerosis workup, which is imaging and spinal fluid studies, because that can often, tell them if that is the diagnosis, and that is the most common diagnosis out of these conditions. I'll say with the advent of increase of MOG testing, the story that's unfolding is slightly different from aquaporin for NMOSD. And I think the terminology will probably change soon. I think people get confused because right now, if somebody meets criteria for NMOSD but don't have the aquaporin for antibodies, that still may be their diagnosis. But if they have MOG antibodies, I often will just refer to that instead of NMOSD. I think that's the more precise diagnosis. But basically what we're seeing in that is that these individuals tend to be younger, often children. The youngest children usually present with an ADEM-like picture. So that can look like encephalopathy, which is a fancy word for being confused, being altered, not really reacting normally. And inflammation can be seen in the brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves. At the initial presentation, about half of kids with ADEM come test positive for MOG. And as we're following MOG testing over time, we're finding that about half of them actually do not mount a permanent response. They don't test persistently positive for MOG. For those individuals, we think that the likelihood of a relapse is quite low. But if it's someone who's had MOG at the beginning and continues to be MOG positive, I think there's a theoretical risk that they have relapses. Currently, our practice has not been to treat persistently positive MOG positive patients, just because there can be a long period between attacks, and we really want people to sort of prove that they're capable. That's not a great way to put it, but that they have the tendency to have relapsing disease before putting them on a immunosuppressive regimen, which has, you know, a lot of potential risks. So I think that's been our practice for those who've tested MOG positive and might be wondering why they are not on a preventative therapy. There's probably some rationale that your clinician is doing, waiting to see if you have another attack or you have persistent positive antibodies. And then, you know, I think this field is changing. Probably in the next few years, we'll have more more firm guidelines on how to manage these patients.
Mm-hmm. There are always a lot of questions that come up about MOG.
Yeah.
You know, the more that we can learn, and that's coming out really very quickly about MOG and even other antibodies that are being discovered, or is always helpful to pare things down in the clinician's mind. And so going into the fifth W, the everyone's favorite and hardest one, the why do people get these disorders? And you were, Dr. Wang, you're describing a little bit, you know, most of these disorders that we talk about and are covered within the TMA are, you know, immune mediated and tend to have a very complex and not clear reasoning as to why those they happen. But now as we're looking at AFM, you described it being potentially driven by a virus. I guess, you know, do you have anything to say about what the research is showing as it pertains to you know, the immunology behind this work, and what we're learning about why these disorders happen?
Yeah, I think the hardest thing is to make a causal link. You know, this even things that can be associated with these conditions, like we often hear a preceding infection, and you know, half to three quarters of the cases of things like acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. It's hard to know if that's just a coincidence. Is that the direct cause? Did it sort of start the cascade of something that then became the cause? So that's always very difficult. And I think that's why, you know, there's a lot of interest in looking at the epidemiological factors. I think I have the benefit of working with young children for the most part. And fortunately, they've only had so many years to be exposed to different things. So I know there's a lot of very compelling work coming out about, you know, potential risk factors for autoimmune disease, primarily MS. Just again, there's more patients who have that, but things like vitamin D status, you know, people who get MS or have more relapses of MS tend to have low vitamin D status. So for anybody who, you know, is listening to this podcast, I recommend that you have that assessed and be on a supplement if you are low in vitamin D. And our standard is usually a little bit higher than the typical, getting the level above 50, usually 50 to 80 is good. So that's one thing, you know, anybody who's had an attack could do to hopefully minimize their chances of having another attack. And then there's other work about looking at the role of obesity, different dietary measures, infectious exposures. So I think there's a lot of that work, but again, making that causal association, making sure that this is a, you know, direct cause is often very hard. And even with something like enterovirus and AFM, the problem is that often by the time that somebody presents with the illness, that virus may have, you know, been excreted from their system and may not be detectable. So we always have the problem of, you know, how can we look for something if they may not be present when the person comes in?
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of theory-driven theory that drives some of this work and can make it difficult. You know, of course, you didn't choose an easy specialty to work in. But yeah, so it's always a complicated answer and, you know, multiple factors that lead to really any autoimmune or immune mediated disease, central nervous system related or not. And so as we're looking at getting into the second half of the podcast, I want to get into a little bit more detailed questions that have come from the community. A lot of really great questions, some very similar that kind of touch on a lot of the same concept. And the first one I wanted to discuss is really about the difference between a disease relapse, regardless of what diagnosis it is, versus a pseudo relapse. Could you give a broad explanation about what that means? Like, by definition, what is a disease relapse versus a pseudo relapse?
Those can actually be quite confusing for, you know, both individuals and their providers, because the symptoms may be exactly the same, whether it's a pseudo relapse or a true relapse. And the difference between those, if it's a real, or if it's a inflammatory relapse, there's some markers that we can tell whether there's new lesions in the central nervous system, signs of inflammation in the spinal fluid. There's often something that will go along with that. Versus pseudo relapse, they tend to be maybe symptoms that somebody has already had as a part of a prior event that becomes sort of triggered or unmasked when somebody's body isn't compensating the best with their circumstances. Situations in which that can be the case include being sick. So nobody ever feels good when they're sick. And if you've had a CNS injury, then definitely that can be revealed, that, you know, things like pain or weakness, fatigue, those can become more prominent with illness. So it's always important when you have new symptoms and they're not going away to talk to your provider about doing some testing to make sure you're not battling an infection. Heat is also a big one, in which people can have a worsening of symptoms when they're overheated, but once they restore a normal body temperature, the symptoms go away. But I would say the things that really can help figure out if it's a new relapse versus a pseudo relapse is the duration of the symptoms. So if they last several days, they're getting worse, they're in a new part of the nervous system. For instance, if you had left optic neuritis and then now you're having right eye blurriness and pain, I think those are pretty good indicators that is a new site of inflammation.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that drive the pseudo relapse. And depending on the extent of the symptoms, it may or may not, you know, really register on some people's radars or the clinician's radars. And even sometimes with relapses, depending on the actual true inflammatory relapses. You touched on some of the reasons behind why pseudo relapses occur: illness, heat, that kind of thing. Can you describe a little bit kind of why? There are some questions that came in as to, you know, why do those symptoms make, or those factors make the symptoms worse that could cause a pseudo relapse or lead to increased neuropathic pain, increased weakness that was pre-existing before? Is there a known reason why that even occurs?
I think, you know, body is always trying to compensate for, you know, if you've more literally, if you've had an injury of a limb, there may be a recovery process and that limb may never work quite as good. And I think the same thing applies for the nervous system. So if there was demyelination, so stripping off the insulating material that allows nerve signals to transmit, if there's any sort of injury of specific areas, then the body's working, you know, twice as hard, however many times as hard to compensate with that. So when it gets, when that balance gets perturbed, things that like heat may not make the signal, you know, propagate as quickly, or you're sick, so you have fatigue, you don't feel well. I think those are the things that kind of kick people out of like some sort of equilibrium. Another thing I often hear is that, you know, the symptoms are persistent, they last long, but they're not quite as dramatic as an attack. And why that might that be? I think as we all age, our bodies are just not able to compensate as well with old injuries. So we often hear that just, you know, walking becomes difficult, and that may not have anything to do with a new attack, but just your body's increasing difficulty with compensating for an injury that happened before. I don't want it to make it sound like that's inevitable. I think there's a lot of things that we can do to improve symptoms. I think a big thing for me is if people are not getting good quality sleep, that will have many ramifications for symptoms such as fatigue and neuropathic pain. So that's probably one of the lowest hanging fruit, that if you have symptoms of snoring or restlessness in sleep, or just not, you know, feeling like you have a good night's sleep, that's really important. Talk to your provider if there are things that can do to help diagnose any sleep issues. That has a very also intricate relationship to mood and energy. So if you feel a lot of depressed mood, that will make sleep more difficult and make other things more difficult. So I want to emphasize that it's very important to look for things that could be contributing to worsening symptoms, such as disordered sleep and mood issues.
Mm. Yeah, and that gets to actually some of the questions that came in as well, as it pertains to kind of cognition, mood, and some of these disorders. One, would you expect cognition and mood to maybe be affected as part of the disease process? And two, you know, as you look forward through the course of somebody's disease process with any of these disorders, and they start complaining about cognitive changes or mood changes, do you think about that as a disease relapse or a pseudo relapse, or is that something that you would refer outside to a different group to think about it being outside of this neuroimmune picture?
I think it depends on the condition. There's some things such as multiple sclerosis where we've seen over time that there can be progressive loss of brain tissue at a higher rate than expected, and that might have to do with some not fully treated autoimmune response. But you know, I think it's for the symptoms that are acute, happen over days to weeks, that are dramatically different, that's definitely more concerning for relapse. But if it's more just kind of subtle things, every year gets a little bit harder than the next, I would again look for those things that can improve mood and sleep. I think people who have these conditions often have more difficulty with exercise for fatigue and, you know, many other reasons, but exercise is very important. So a lot of the follow-up after the initial episode is to see how we can optimize these factors that really, you know, give your brain and your central nervous system some reserve to compensate when there are stressors placed on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's interesting. And, you know, there's a little bit of information out there about transverse myelitis in particular and cognition within that might be affected in process of transverse myelitis that is counter to what one might expect. You know, you don't think that damage in the spinal cord would necessarily lead to cognitive issues, but there, you know, Dr. Mm-hmm. Wang, you speak more fully to this about the data that might exist or how you might think about that in the context of maybe non-brain based diseases that might present, or a patient might present with some cognitive changes that you wouldn't expect as part of normal aging.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Actually, some of our colleagues here at UT mm-hmm. Southwestern have done some of that work, including Dr. Lana Harder and Dr. Benjamin Greenberg. You know, they had this question, what would be an ideal control group for, MS, because it's primarily a brain-based disorder, And we have this transverse myelitis population where we, to our knowledge, thought all the inflammation occurred in the spinal cord. So why would they have these ongoing cognitive issues that don't have to do with fatigue or sleep or mood? So I think that gets at a really interesting question. Is there subclinical inflammation that our tools are just not as good to detect? Or is there something about inflammation that may, inflammation either one time or ongoing that has some effect on brain circuits and function of the brain? So I think it's very compelling, still not quite at a point where we can know for sure. And then, again, some of these conditions affect more than one areas. And, when we get to better and better imaging techniques, we're finding that not just the white matter is affected in these conditions. So sort of where the wires run from different parts of the brain and spinal cord, but also the gray matter, which is sort of where the cells are. So our MRIs are not good at imaging gray matter. And it seems like a lot of the pathology, a lot of the reason for some symptoms people can have over time actually has to do with gray matter changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like you said, it's difficult at this point in time to follow that. And I mean, I think, again, in my observation of the clinicians and how you guys think and work through this, nobody's going to say, oh no, that's not, cognition changes mm-hmm. are not ever going to be a part of this or that diagnosis, because, again, we're learning new things every day. And to all the reasons that you pointed out, you as the clinician have to be cognizant of the whole person and everything that could come from it. Moving on a little bit, there are some questions that came in as it pertains to the kind of monophasic versus relapsing question. There are people who have had, say, a transverse myelitis attack, and it's been 5, 10, 15 years since that happened, with no, maybe they have pseudo relapses or symptoms, but no new inflammatory process. Is there any kind of, timeline or time frame where you as a clinician say, oh, it's been 10 years, mm-hmm. so we're going to not follow you as closely, or we're going to call this a single time event? What's your thinking about that?
Certainly the longer that you've not had a relapse, the better, but we can predict that it's less and less likely to happen. Now that we're more sophisticated in testing for these autoantibodies, if you had your event before these antibody tests were available, that would be something to definitely talk to your provider about, because that can give us more information about prognosis. So that is one thing you can help answer that question. And then, I don't know if I would put a specific time. It seems like for many of these diseases, if you haven't had any disease activity in 5-10 years, then you're more in the clear. But for things like anti-MOG related disease, we've certainly seen children who have acute disseminated encephalomyelitis when they're 4 or 5, and then come in with optic neuritis in their late teens. So there can be a natural period of no disease activity, even without treatment. So I think it's really hard to make that call. But again, the longer that you've gone, the better it is. People who tend to have these, I think, maybe later in life. So potentially, not as a part of a syndrome that is relapsing, such as multiple sclerosis or NMOSD or MOG. I think those people tend to not have relapses as well. But yeah, it's all kind of in general and kind of general guiding principles.
Yeah. And then what about those cases, or you kind of touched on this with the MOG question, but if somebody's gone, they have their first attack and then they have their next attack 10 years later, 9, 10, 11 years later, that would be considered a relapsing disease from what you've been describing. But then how do you think about managing that looking forward as a clinician? Do you get concerned that there will be more frequent relapses? Or are you thinking that maybe there's just, you know, might be another 10 years before there could be another relapse? Do you start on some kind of immune therapy? You know, these are difficult questions that a lot of clinicians have different ideas about how to manage it. But could you speak a little bit to how you think about that situation?
Yeah, I think we definitely try to look at the specifics of that person's disease. Since they had bilateral optic neuritis that was quite profound, like during the acute parts of the episode, they may have completely lost vision and as a result sustained pretty significant injury that we could actually measure the back of their eyes and see that they did sustain quite a lot of tissue injury. That might make me a little bit more likely to recommend therapy, especially if they have another attack. Very rarely at the first onset of a illness such as MOG antibody disease do we actually put somebody on immunotherapy, but I think most of the field has moved toward if you have two attacks, then for now, until we get more information, we're going to put you on something because we don't want to risk you having additional injury that leads to some form of more permanent disability. So it really depends first on sort of how severe the attack was and what the recovery was like, and then also partly due to the preferences of the family and the clinician and talking about risks. So some families will tolerate a lot of risk as long as they can prevent their child from having another episode, and that's their priority, and we definitely try to integrate that with our decision making recommendations. Some families say, it could be another 10, 20 years. I don't want to expose my child or my, family member to that risk. So can we just do close monitoring? And I think there's not enough strong data that would, make any of our recommendations mandatory. I think the only exception is NMOSD, which I think most providers feel very strongly about treatment after the first attack.
Mm. Yes, that makes sense. Shifting gears a little bit to a different kind of question as it relates to AFM. And again, AFM being pretty new on the radar and in comparison, there are questions that come up about after an AFM occurs, say years or so after an AFM occurs, and the potential for something like a post-polio syndrome. And is that something that they need to, or the clinician should be thinking about expecting with our experience with polio in the context of AFM? I think, of course, there's a lot of unknowns here, but could you speak a little bit more to, I guess, one, what post-polio syndrome was, what that is, what that looks like, and do you think that that might also apply as we look ahead at the future for AFM patients?
Yeah, so, post-polio syndrome, typically polio affected younger people, children most commonly, and, over time as they get into middle age, older age, a lot of times people who had gotten better from some of the weakness that they were afflicted during the acute process, they would find, difficulties with strength and walking. So I think it gets at the thing that we discussed earlier about, everybody has a certain reserve. They have a capacity where their body can kind of compensate and make up for any changes that kind of stress the system. And I think as we all age, we know that brain tissue decreases, a lot of things wear out, and I think it does get to a point where, this is probably a gradual process, but at some point it becomes obvious clinically because you're not able to do the things. So many of our AFM affected individuals are so young that I feel like this is many decades. It's very hard to know what it will look like and if it will look like post-polio, but I think that possibility is there because, once someone has some injury in those areas, and those areas, continue to maybe decline as we age, I think it is possible that that happens. That's why it's important that we stress the role of just, rehab and doing as much as we can to recover and regain functions. So there's definitely a big push within AFM community and ourselves to really advocate for ongoing physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy if needed. So the more we can sort of set, put the odds in our favor that you have as much recovery and as much reserve as possible, I think the less likely a post-polio syndrome will occur.
Yeah, I think that's important, keeping in mind, like you said, what we all know the natural aging process is, compounding the inflammatory process that either is ongoing or the damage that previously occurred, keeping that in mind, and also general health, just managing your general health, like you were saying, trying to get good sleep, the importance of rehab, physical therapy, at least as needed over time, and diet and exercise, all of these things that we know we should all probably be doing better or more of, is maybe even that much more important for patients with neuroimmune disorders, or at least they're more sensitive to those changes than maybe the general population. As it pertains again to AFM, you were talking about post-polio syndrome being over, you know, as the child with polio then was an adult, later adult, having these issues with weakness and such. With what you'd be thinking with a current AFM patient, say a child who had a, we'll say, quote unquote, typical AFM presentation, and a year or two later, so not far into adulthood, but just later, start having an increased weakness, start going downhill a little bit. Do you think of that as a pseudo relapse in the way that you would think of something like with the typical transverse myelitis, or does that make you think of something different?
Yeah, I think since just we've never seen a true relapse, and you know, we've definitely heard symptoms, or we've heard patients say, like, you know, their child or themselves are getting weaker over time, and we've imaged those people and done testing, and we never find any new signs of inflammation. And when we really dig into the details of the history, we often find that maybe they took a break from physical therapy, or they had a really bad flu or cold that really set them back. So I think being a good historian, trying to find if there are any potential causes that explains a relative decline is important. And then if there is true decline and new inflammation, then I think always being open-minded to the possibility that the first diagnosis that you receive may not be the correct one. And in some cases, we've actually seen MOG-related disease have a very similar appearance to AFM in the spinal cord, so primarily affecting the gray matter in the spinal cord. So again, I think this is why it's so important to have a very close and, you know, a relationship with, you know, presumably a neurology provider, but someone who can help answer these questions and be up to date on the field as it continues to evolve.
There's a lot of more information that is needed for AFM. I know all of these questions specifically about AFM are difficult to answer with what we know right now. As we're moving toward the last 10 minutes or so of the podcast, there's one other question as it relates to kind of relapse or pseudo relapse. Some questions that have come in, you know, a lot of, especially I think transverse myelitis patients, but I guess this could be with you know, any of these disorders, kind of have ongoing issues of pain, fatigue, those neuropathic, specifically neuropathic pain issues that presumably might be from the nerve damage from the inflammatory attack. There are some questions that come in about, you know, if that's ongoing, does that concern you for ongoing disease process? And then also, if you have, you know, constant pain that you think is due to damage, but it starts spreading or getting worse, does that make you think that there's the disease process is ongoing, or would you treat that more as a nerve damage problem?
Yeah, symptoms are always hard just without like a context. So the context is always important. And, you know, if it's worsening pain and medications that treat neuropathic pain symptomatically benefit your symptoms, then it's more likely it was some complication or some sequelae of the injury. If you have pain that's worsening, spreading to parts of the nervous system that never were affected in the initial attack, then that would raise, I think, a red flag about could this be new disease. And I think pain and fatigue, those are so so pervasive in the field that I just, you know, it's always good to know for optimizing all the things such as sleep and, you know, ways of improving the pain. And pain can often be different things. So I think you alluded to neuropathic pain, which tends to be more of a electrical burning pins and needles type pain rather than, you know, a musculoskeletal pain or like a muscle spasm pain. So also taking more time to go through with your provider, the type of pain can be helpful to direct the type of treatments, because we know certain medications can help with neuropathic pain versus muscular pain versus spasms and hypertonia or high tone pain. So I think being very granular about the symptom and keeping good history. So, you know, when you go to your provider, they may ask you a lot of questions, being prepared for that interaction by documenting and thinking through those symptoms as much as possible really helps them to make a good decision for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, just in my interactions with different people living with these disorders, it's, you know, it's a hard problem to tackle. I think generally, you know, in neurology and medicine in general, pain is a difficult thing to pin down. And to identify even the causes of it and the treatment of it, because it can be so subjective. So it's a hard thing to tackle as a clinician, as a healthcare provider, and a very difficult thing to live with as a general person living in society. Yeah. So as we're looking toward again, closer to the end of this podcast, there have been some very interesting questions that have come up during the course of the podcast. And there's one that I wanted to touch base on that isn't really covered through a lot of these neuroimmune conversations when you're thinking about immune-mediated damage in the context of a cancer, what can be called a paraneoplastic disease. Could you speak a little bit to what that is, how that relates to the transverse myelitises and the NMOSDs of the world that we're more familiar with, and especially as that relates to relapsing disease?
Yeah, so paraneoplastic encephalitis or myelitis or, you know, paraneoplastic anything just refers to a very a more specialized type of autoimmune or immune reaction. So when we talk about autoimmune encephalitis, we just say the immune system is doing something and it's causing the problem. In paraneoplastic diseases, in some ways, the immune system is trying to do its best to do something good or productive, which is often to attack a cancer that may be growing. And sort of what's caught in the crossfires is maybe proteins that the cancer is making that resembles proteins in other parts of the body. So the typical areas where cancer can lead to paraneoplastic syndrome are lung cancer. There's a special type of ovarian mass called a teratoma, some breast cancer, some thymus and thyroid cancer. So in this way, the immune system isn't so much confused or perturbed. It's trying to do its best to fight off something. So one way to reduce the neurological symptoms is to decrease sort of the fuel of the immune system, which is the cancer itself, by treating the cancer. So that approach is a bit different. So we want to remove sort of the trigger for this abnormal immune response, which is the cancer. So it definitely requires a neurologist to follow the neurological symptoms, but also working with an oncologist to see how the cancer could be best treated and eradicated.
Yeah, so if you have a scenario where a patient has breast cancer and has a paraneoplastic neurologic disorder as because of that, and you can pinpoint it, and then the cancer is is treated, it's removed, and there's, by and large, everything looks like it's supposed to. Do you, as the neurologist, have any concern for relapse of neurological symptoms, or is it really directly related to the cancer itself, so that you might only think about it if the cancer returns?
I think part of that workup definitely should include reassessing if the cancer may have come back, and knowing that our tools aren't perfect, that sometimes cancers can be very small and hard to find just, you know, through imaging alone or through certain techniques of imaging. So sometimes we'll do different types of imaging to get at that information. But even in some conditions where it started as a paraneoplastic process, sometimes the immune system, you know, how in whatever way can get trained into having an abnormal response, and even with the cancer being gone, continue. One thing I think is important to highlight with paraneoplastic diseases, these are autoimmune, but they tend to be different in that it's not antibodies that are attacking like the cell surface of cells. I'm probably going a little bit more into detail, but oftentimes these types of immune responses actually kill off tissue in the brain rather than be a reversible process. So a lot of people who've had paraneoplastic diseases, they may not actually expect to get better after getting immunotherapy. The immunotherapy is usually to halt the symptoms, versus some of these autoimmune diseases where we think it's the antibody driving a temporary response. Once we get rid of the antibody, get rid of the abnormal immune response, people can recover. Unfortunately, we don't tend to see as much symptomatic recovery with paraneoplastic diseases.
Yeah, I always found that to be of all of the stuff when the paraneoplastic cases would come up in the neuroimmunology clinic, those were always, difficult cases to work through and complicated cases. Yeah.
And I think it was definitely important we covered that, but for the vast majority of the conditions that we covered, especially in those that are affecting younger individuals, children in particular, I think there's a role to consider that, but I would not, I usually do not do too much imaging looking for a paraneoplastic cause, just with the risk of radiation safety in young population. And I can't really think of any paraneoplastic types of ADAM, or and even optic neuritis and transverse myelitis paraneoplastic diseases are very rare. So I think other symptoms would have to help point in that direction, such as weight loss, weight loss, night sweats, chills, that kind of thing that kind of go along with a cancer process.
Very, very interesting. So we just have a few more minutes left. Do you have any final thoughts, Dr. Wang, on this topic, or really the takeaways about relapsing versus monophasic disease, and the difference between relapse and pseudo-relapse?
I would just say, yeah, now more important than ever, I think people who've had one of these episodes, it's important for you to continue to, you know, find out if new information are emerging. When I was training, we often would see kids with ADAM, and if they recovered, we would not continue to follow them. And I think there's now a more important role to continue to follow people and learn about the natural history of these conditions. I think pseudo-relapses are a very common question, and I definitely don't want to deter anybody from reaching out to their provider if they have concern. But yeah, I think it's something that once you've had your condition over time, you get a sense of what's a true new symptom of inflammation versus what's, you know, something may just be a part of your body not quite compensating as well.
And a big takeaway for me is the general health, managing general health, and how great of an effect that can have on ongoing neurologic symptoms and even the potential for pseudo relapses.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's so many things interrelated between mood and sleep and fatigue that, you know, if one of those aren't optimized, then it's challenging because it can be a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Dr. Wang, for your time and your willingness to speak to this important topic. I want to thank everyone who contributed their questions. They were really great questions. I know we weren't able to get to all of them, we will take these questions and have them inform future podcasts. But thank you for everybody's involvement and interest. And thank you to the TMA for allowing this platform. So I hope everybody has a great Thursday into Friday and end of the weekend. So thank you again, Dr. Wang, and we'll see you off.
Yep. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.